Isaiah, very messianic book of prophecy from about 700 years before the time of Jesus, but constantly called upon in the New Testament to give focus and clarity to exactly who Jesus is. So when we're reading it here, obviously we're looking at the idea, who is Jesus? And give some shape to that, not just have vague ideas about it. We talked about prophecy and the role of the prophets. It's not all about prediction about the future. It's about seeing into what's happening in its day. But there is, of course, the idea of looking toward the future. And we found that when it comes to fulfillment of prophecy, there's a layered quality to it. Often the prophecies have some type of fulfillment. You might call it fulfillment, partial fulfillment, in a time closer to the day. But then they look out into the future and they see Jesus and they even see the end of the world. And you think, well, that's the end. That's the real fulfillment. And so that thing that happens first almost just becomes an affirmation and a positive, something that just once again confirms that something yet is to happen to bring this all about. And we see a lot of that going on in the book of Isaiah. When we look at a book of 66 chapters, and we said it really changes, and in particular it changes around chapter 40. And at chapter 40 it takes off, well, even before that, and starts looking more into the future. It gets a little less anchored to the events around Isaiah's time. But you don't want to make too much of that point. I mean, that's going on. We're still back in the chapters before chapter 40, and I want to look at chapter 15 and 16 today, and consider one of these areas of prophecy that, looks forward a little bit, but this really does happen in Isaiah's day. Now, this type of Old Testament reading takes a little bit more work, obviously, because you might look at this and say, well, I need to know a little more background. I need to know what's being referred to here, and it's not going to be on the tip of your tongue, or if it is, you might not be quite normal. We're going to look at the book of Moab. You've heard of that. Speaking of being slightly deranged, Moab. Well, that's an interesting topic, and concerns. It's one of the people that are around ancient Judah, ancient Israel. Very important player in the story, but one that's, as I said, not on the tip of everyone's tongue. And you might have to say, well, what does Moab have to do with anything? What does this teaching have to do with us? And I think we can answer that question a little bit. So, Moab. Let's talk about that for a moment. Where is Moab? What's that? Beside the Dead Sea. On which side of the Dead Sea? Oh, come on. What a girl answer. Sorry, Rebecca. The east side. Yeah, the east side of the thank you. I'm just teasing about that girl thing. It's an old C.S. Lewis line, right? Girls never know what the place on the compass is. So no lesser authority than C.S. Lewis said that. I always have some woman just get really angry at me saying, I always know north, south, east, and west. My husband doesn't have a clue. You know, and they're really, it's a joke. Lighten up. Thank you. It's on the east side of the Sea of Galilee. It's down there. So if you have, or not the Sea of Galilee, the Dead Sea. What am I talking about? Over in this area here. So you know, Jerusalem's up here, and you know, the rest of Israel's going on there, Mediterranean. That's a great map. Down in this area. All right. Moab is an interesting place. What's it famous for? Fruit, yeah. And what name? Ruth. Oh, okay. Sorry, I'm deaf. I don't know. All right. Ruth. Yeah. Well, Ruth is there. I thought you said fruit. So I went into an Arby's, and the young woman behind the counter had a real soft voice, and she was asking me if I wanted the senior discount. And I couldn't hear it. I was like, what? What? And she's like, would you like the senior's discount? But heavens no! Not old enough, you know. But she thought, not only is he old and senile, but he's deaf as well. You know, it's a... Okay. Uh,
a fortuitous accident. Fruit.
Yes, it is famous for fruit, even though you didn't say that. And what fruit in particular is Moab famous for? I hear it, I think. Grapes.
And what do you do with grapes? Oh, yeah. It's a big wine area
back in those days, and the wine of Moab was considered really fabulous wine. And actually, we'll see that Moab, of course, keeps figuring into Jewish history. It's an important region right on their borders, but Jeremiah chapter 48 goes into a long prophecy regarding Moab, and it's all talking about it in terms of wine and winemaking, that, you know, Moab has lived in peace, and it's like wine that has settled on its lees, and lees, I guess, being the precipitate that falls out of wine when you're fermenting it. And, you know, all these kind of, I don't want to say puns, but just sort of images of Moab based on winemaking. And their wine is apparently fabulous. So it's a fairly, I guess, to me, when I look at it now, it looks kind of deserty there. It doesn't look like a prosperous area, but I get the feeling it was a comfortable, prosperous, and perhaps in the crossroads a little bit of some things in history, but nobody really bugged them much so that they could live fairly comfortable lives there in Moab. And we'll see that come up. Now, let's consider them just briefly in terms of Scripture, and we have to start with the sort of the history of Moab as told by the Jews, which starts in Genesis chapter 19. So would you turn there with me? And we'd have to say this is one of the weirder passages of Scripture in the Old Testament, but I think it bears looking at here. And remember that they probably regarded this differently than we do. But would somebody read verses 30 through 37, Genesis 19? Okay. Now, as far as the Jews were concerned, this kind of tells the story of the origins of Moab. And you think, this is incest. This is horrifying, isn't it? It's got wine involved, you know, put a little wine in the Moabitic DNA, you know, that they're already on this track. Where have these girls grown up, by the way? Sodom. They actually were engaged to men from Sodom. This is the story, you know, Lot flees Sodom at the hands of the angels with his two daughters, and they end up in this situation eventually, not directly, since they settled in Zoar first. But that's a pretty brutal story of the origin of a people. Now remember, this is pre-Mosaic law, and so their view of incest and its legality might be a little bit different, but yet there seems to be kind of a natural and universal repugnance at this idea. And so I think the Jews say, well, this is the origin of Moab. And so they become kind of a viewed as something of a mongrel race, as racist as that sounds, that they're connected because Lot, of course, is Abraham's nephew. So they're kin, but they're kin, you know, founded in a relationship that starts, shall we say, in less than totally savory terms. So that's the beginning of Moab, the descendants of one of Lot's daughters and Lot. They keep showing up in the Scriptures. Now, we know, of course, that the Jews end up in Egypt. You know the whole story of Joseph and how the Jews end up in Egypt for about 400 years. And, of course, come back under God's calling into the Promised Land. They encounter the Moabites once more as they do this. So we need to look at Numbers chapter 22. By this time, that group of people that starts from that relationship in a cave out in that area has grown into actually a nation. It has its own big boundary. So we need, let's see, when we get to Numbers chapter 22, would somebody read us verses 1 through... Okay, great. And good pronunciations on those. It's a tough to read these things. Okay, now you know this story, right? Now, so... hundreds of years have passed, of course, you know, and Israel's been in Egypt. Now they're heading back up into the Promised Land. And they're trying to actually just pass through the territory of the Amorites and Moabites as kind of distant kin, but it isn't to be. I mean, it gets violent because they don't necessarily see this relationship of kinship that Israel's trying to establish with them. And in particular, they get this prophet Balaam to come and curse them. And you know this story, of course, right? What happens in this story? Yeah, the donkey talks. You know, the classic case of Balaam trying to get to the place where he will go and meet the king and curse the Israelites as they're coming in. And of course, the donkey won't go down the road. It turns out there's an angel in the road blocking their way, and the donkey actually starts to talk to the prophet, which of course is a wild story, and many jokes have been told about it since then, which I probably don't need to repeat, do I? I do? You've never heard them? No. I don't know. Ask me tomorrow. No. But they involve God speaking through a jackass, literally. And many jokes have been told about this over the history of preaching, you know, as to how this started way back when. Let's look at Numbers 25, 1 through 4. The attempt to call Balaam in to curse the Israelites is a dismal failure because he of course starts blessing Israel rather than cursing them because that's the prophecy that God puts on his heart. Good so far. That's not the end of the story, though, of the Jews trying to get past the Moabites to get into the promised land. And we see another situation here in chapter 25, verses 1 through 4. Would somebody read that? Okay. Now there's another tremendous passage in some ways. How would you characterize, shall we say, Israeli-Moabite relations at this point? Maybe not quite tense enough in the case of Numbers 25, right? Oh, okay. Yeah, a little too comfortable with in 25. What's the picture of Moab that has emerged now as a group of people? Yeah, I would say that they've kind of got a straight line from you might say from Sodom, which of course you know is sort of the picture of evil as far as the book of Genesis is concerned, down to Moab through Lot's daughters. I mean, it seems like you can almost draw a line there and say that the same kind of immorality is just seems to be passed down through this culturally. And so of course, it's not a comfortable relationship by any means. But it is interesting because of what Bob said, the thing I misheard here. Why don't we look at Ruth chapter 1, verse 1. Go to Judges, and then it's one more book, right? Joshua, Judges, Ruth. You'll find it there. Somebody have Ruth chapter 1, verse 1 for us. Okay, very good. Now that seems like simple enough information there. But it does maybe give us that glimpse that perhaps Moab does sort of have a little more prosperity agriculturally or a little more stable kind of environment. But if we know the story of Ruth is launched here, that means Ruth is a Moabitess, as a I think they call her in the King James. That means that Ruth is a ancestor of whom? She's a descendant of Lot, but she is an ancestor herself of David, right? Because this comes down through David's father, comes to us through Ruth, that whole story. And if she's if David is a descendant, then who else is a descendant? Jesus. So, our straight line just got real crooked, didn't it? To draw a straight pass from Sodom to Moab seems pretty like a sure bet at one point, but then you think, but there's a different story emerging from the line of Moab, and that's that Jesus himself will find genetic inheritance from that line. Interesting stuff. Now, if we get down the path here, we'll see that this does not mean that there are normal or good or friendly relationships between Moab and Israel. In 2 Samuel chapter 8, for example, David conquers some of the territory there. 2 Samuel 8. After this, it came to pass that David attacked the Philistines and subdued them, and David took Metheg-Amah from the hand of the Philistines. Then he defeated Moab, forcing them. This is a brutal passage. Forcing them to the ground, he measured them off with a line. With two lines, he measured off those to be put to death, and with one full line, those to be kept alive. So the Moabites became David's servants and brought tribute. you know, an episode of great brutality from the career of David. 2 Kings chapter 3, we'll see Moab will appear again. This remember we talked about what the problem was with our bad king. Remember our bad king in the reign of Ahab? What is the matter with my brain and tongue today? King Ahaz was the bad king, remember? And we said what makes him characteristically bad? Well, the sacrifice of his children. Look at this. And when the king of Moab saw that the battle was too fierce for him, he took with him 700 men who drew swords to break through to the king of Edom, but they could not. Then he took his eldest son, who would have reigned in his place, and offered him as a burnt offering upon the wall. And there was great indignation against Israel. So they departed from him and returned to their own land. Very peculiar passage. Okay, so we've got this picture of Moab, and we've got this picture of their relationships with Moab throughout history. And now in the book of Isaiah, in chapter 15, 16, we turn our attention to that particular country. Now at this point in the book of Isaiah, we're kind of going back and forth. I mean, Isaiah's passing judgment on Israel, the kingdom in the north. He's passing judgment on Egypt, Ethiopia, lands around them, on Judah itself and Jerusalem, but it seems like nobody is quite out of the line of judgment here. So we want to look now, what does Isaiah, by the time we get down the road, because we're way down the road at this point. I mean, let me think about time here for just a second. It'd be about, from, for example, that time period when in 2 Kings, to this time period in Isaiah would have been about 150 years. So from that time that where the king of Moab is turning his own eldest son into a sacrifice, so about 150 years, thereabouts, you know, close to 200 years will have passed by the time you get down to the time of Isaiah. So we're looking at Isaiah chapters 15 and 16. And I want to look at a couple of different layers here. First of all, we want to look at sort of the bad news that's here. And then there's something else, though, that's going to surprise us. So could somebody look at Isaiah 15, 1 through 3, and read it to us? Okay. You have this picture that now Isaiah has a vision about Moab. And how does it look? Bad. Looks like there's going to be what? Yeah. And that's described kind of poetic, you know, heads with baldness, every beard cut off. The streets will fill with sackcloth, you know, people in sackcloth. You think, time of great mourning will wail, weep bitterly. And that's the picture that we see here. Let's see what else we can read. Let's read 16. Well, let's do it this way. Let's read 16:10 and find out, well, what's the description of what's going to happen? 16:10. Yeah, fascinating picture there. And you think of you know, the joy of the wine harvest and people shouting and carrying on. He says the joy is going to be gone, gladness taken away, no more shouting, nor treaders will tread out the wine in the presses. I have made their shouting cease. And you might think, well, what on earth did they do to deserve this? I mean, what is exactly the nature of their guilt? And, well, we have to fish that out of these two chapters here. I mean, what did they do wrong? We will look at 16:6 to figure this out. Somebody want to read it? 16:6. Okay, very good. So this horrible, devastating vision of what's going to happen to Moab, all its joy is going to cease, is kind of a judgment against its pride and haughtiness. Do you think pride and haughtiness is that big of a problem that it should merit this kind of wrath from God? Yeah, I mean, think of all the sins that could get you in trouble in a church, you know. I mean, you could list them, and especially when you're dealing with a legacy like Sodom and Moab, you know, you'd think, well, there'd all be, you know, all kinds of more glamorous sins than that. But haughtiness and arrogance can kind of fly under the radar for most Christians, can't it? There you go, pride. And what Bob's saying, fruit. No, pride, right? Is the thing. Okay. Isn't it become the launch point of the sinful discipline? Why is pride at the top of the list of seven deadly sins? Well, how does that work? Yeah, I mean, I think you don't submit when you're proud, and we'll see that actually this prophecy against Moab, this disposition. Remember, I told you that in Jeremiah 48, when it goes into a long prophecy against Moab and plays with the images of winemaking, the same charge is there in Jeremiah. I'll just turn to it and read it to you. Chapter 48, verse 29, I think we'll say about the same thing about Moab. We have heard of the pride of Moab. He is exceedingly proud of his loftiness and arrogance and pride and of the haughtiness of his heart. And Jeremiah makes the same judgment against him. Okay, now let's look at something surprising. So we've got the situation. We've got the picture of their history. We've got the picture of now Isaiah's got this burden concerning them. And you think now we're going to get even with Moab, right? You'd think this is this would be good prophecy, right? Because you're prophesying against the evil Moabites. You would think, wouldn't you? I mean, this is Israel's enemy. These are the people David trounced. These are the people that are, you know, they had trouble with as they were coming out of the promised land. You would think, well, how does Isaiah understand the prophecy he sees? And I think we'll find it surprising. So let's go back through some of these, pull a few verses out here and see what his reaction to this is. Look at chapter 15, verse 5. And we'll see how the prophet responds to the vision he's getting about Moab, and I think it's surprising. Somebody read us that, please. Verse 5, Horonaim. I think if you actually look these up in pronouncing books, you'll find that since they're not all Hebrew names and nobody really quite knows how they're pronounced, so, you know, just pronounce every syllable and you're close, you know, just don't emphasize anything and you'll be safe. But look at the first line. How is it? My heart will cry out for Moab. There's pain in Isaiah as he sees this vision of what's going to happen to them. Look at 16, verse 11. Somebody read that for us. No big words there to pronounce. Yeah, all right. So, therefore my heart shall resound like a harp for Moab. Yeah, plucking his heartstrings. With major chords or minor chords? Yeah, minor chords, strange modal, you know, things that sound sad. I mean, there's pain, isn't there? I mean, isn't Isaiah saying that this vision is giving him tremendous pain to see Moab treated this way? I think, well, that's interesting. This is not the image of the prophet as a denunciatory person who sort of delights in God's judgment of the people. Is actually bringing him enormous anguish is the only way to describe it. Well, what are they supposed to do about it? I think this becomes one of the interesting parts of the passage. So we have to, once again, we've seen the history, we've seen the nature of the judgment, what's going to happen to them, and yet we've seen the prophet actually in deep turmoil over what's going to become of them, not at all unconcerned. And then we see what God tells them to do about it, which is in 16, 1 through 5. Would somebody read that to us? Okay, now that's an interesting thing too. Not only is his heart in anguish, but God's message as to how to treat the Moabites. Now, we assume, I'm not sure exactly how this prophecy will unfold, that they are in line of fire with Assyria. The Assyria will be kind of the punishing agent here, and we've talked about how they conducted warfare and how vicious and brutal they were. And apparently Moab now in the line in Assyrian sights. And what is Judah apparently supposed to do for them in this case and send the lamb? What do you suppose that's about? Well, actually, these were gifts of tribute that kings sent to others, and even Moab actually sent tribute lambs to another. It was a symbolic gift. You know, we're your vassal state. You know, we submit to you. But in fact, it seems that the Jews are being told to send a lamb to Moab, which is very startling image there. And Moab is described as a wandering bird pushed out of the nest, and so shall the daughters of Moab at the fords of Anan. And so what are they to do for them? Let's go down through the list here. You're in verse 3. What are you supposed to do? Right. Take counsel, execute judgment, and then do what? How? How's that described? Do you have that make your shadow? Isn't that an interesting? Make a shadow like the night in the middle of the day. Hide the outcasts. Do not betray him who escapes. How do you picture that shade image? Yeah, it's a beautiful poetic image. I mean, I spend, a couple weeks in the desert, it seems, about every summer. My mom lives in the desert. And you get that sun, that brutal sun. And believe me, walking around in it, shade is a precious commodity. And the difference between the light and the shade is just, I mean, here in Ohio where it's gray all the time, you just, somebody just needs to turn the lights on here. But go to some place where the sun shines, and shade is a remarkable thing. It's so refreshing, and it's so welcome. And the sun can be pretty brutal, and getting out of the sun and into the shade is a remarkable thing. I mean, it's a pleasant thing. You're saying, you are to be this for him. And hide the outcast. Do not betray him who escapes. Tell me something about that. Does that raise anything in your mind? Considering Assyria is the aggressor. Risk, big risk, I would think. I mean, to shelter the people that are being driven from a big, aggressive, and scary country like that really is to put yourself in danger. You're harboring, and that's not usually looked upon kindly. Let my outcasts, what's significant there? The pronoun, my outcasts, dwell with you. Be a shelter to them from the face of the spoiler. For the extortioner is at an end, devastation ceases, the oppressors are consumed out of the land. What are we turning the corner on and looking here? Well, it's looking at, in a sense, the redemption of Moab is being hinted at here, right? That which is oppressing them is going to come to an end. You know, it's not the final story that the Moab will be rolled over and devastated, but in fact, devastation will cease. The oppressors will be consumed out of the land. And then we have the great verse 5. And Rob's had in love, I have in mercy. You might have either one. That's a tricky word to translate in Hebrew. In mercy, the throne will be established, and one will sit on it in the tabernacle of David, judging and seeking justice and hastening righteousness. What are we talking about? I would say, because who sits on the throne of David, and how will his throne be established? Well, in love and in mercy. It will be established. And so we look down the road and say, well, Moab is in God's sights as well, right? Not just the Jews in Israel, but Moab itself now is sort of being summoned up and put in the picture of messianic prophecies. So you to say, what does this say to us as we look at it? I mean, you go through this little lesson now. I mean, I hope you'll remember at least for another couple weeks, a little bit about Moab. And you say, Isaiah had a burden about Moab. Surprisingly, he doesn't delight in it. He mourns and feels anguish over it. And in that prophecy that we learn that the Jewish people, the Judah, is to actually shelter Moab, which is a dangerous thing to do in their age. And in the prophecy then, a glimpse is looked out all the way down to Jesus. What would you say is in this for us? If you had to say, well, what's the lesson? Very good. Including the daughters of Lot who are mourning on the banks of the Arnon, the daughters of Moab. Very much story of redemption. So all these things show us something about God's character, right? I mean, who is God and how does he work with people? I mean, I think this fills out our picture of who God is and what he's like. You like the idea that in mercy the throne will be established. God's love of mercy is very strong here. I don't know about you, but I kind of feel like, Sodom as grim as it is. I mean, we all stand in the line of Sodom. I mean, that is not just a picture of Sodom, but a picture of the human race. Maybe not in the specifics, but I mean, we're more like Sodom than we are like the New Jerusalem. When we think about it, and God's great mercy in this is very important to me. Let me read you a quotation from the New Bible Commentary, commenting on this little passage in 16. It is a little classic on the caring church, calling it to give its mind counsel. Remember what we were supposed to do there, take counsel, execute judgment, make a shadow. Saying, calling it to give its mind counsel, its conscience grant justice, and its strength, as described in verses 3 and 4, to the welfare of the outcasts, whom God seems to name strikingly, my outcasts. Moab, it is in key with the messianic regime glimpsed at the end of this neglected oracle. Yeah, that's a great, the only thing I find this in brainy commentaries. It is in key with the messianic regime glimpsed at the end of this neglected oracle. Yeah, so we don't look at this prophecy in particular and think of, Jesus, it's not one of the ones that found its way into our carols, I don't think, and some of our more common messianic prophecies. But you think, there's an interesting one delivered in the case of Moab. And you notice, it's a classic on the caring church, calling it to give its mind. That's us, the welfare of the outcast, who God seems to name strikingly, my outcasts. Well, mercy is the issue, and I think that that's the thing that's enduring to me as God, a permanent part of God's character. I thought we should end. Of course, there are many, many passages of Scripture. His mercy endures forever. His mercy endures forever through the Psalms. But I was thinking we should end with Matthew chapter 5, verse 7. Somebody read that to us. Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy. So let me give you just a little pastoral exhortation here as we close. Where, when, and with whom do you feel you could show some mercy this week?